Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast Series. I'm Heather Horn, a partner in PwC's national office and the host of this series. This is our last episode of 2019. Thank you for tuning in each week and for helping us grow. We'll be taking a break over PwC's holiday shutdown, and I hope that all of you listeners find time to focus on friends, family, fitness, travel, whatever wellness and recharging your energy means to you. We'll see you back here in 2020. But before you head off, we've got one more episode. As many of you are aware, I'm also the host of our quarterly Accounting and Reporting Developments webcast. Our webcast last week focused on New Year's resolutions for accountants. If you missed it, please check out CFO Direct for a CPE-eligible replay of the webcast that will be available soon. However, in the meantime, in the interest of getting the new year off to a good start, today's podcast will focus on some of the frequently asked questions received during the webcast. Joining me in the studio are some of the guests that appeared on the webcast: Cassie Bauman, Maria Constantino, Seth Drucker, Angela Ferguson, and Mark Jerusalem. There's a lot to talk about, so we're going to jump straight in. All right, so Seth, on CECL, you talked about implementation and testing of key controls over the end-to-end process, but then we got some questions like, what do we mean when we're saying that? So can you give us some detail?
Sure. I mean, I think the key message is that implementation is broader than just the CECL calculation or the number, right? So there's work to be done up until the point of when you go live, but then once you go live, the work isn't finished. So really what the whole process point is that you're talking about where you get the information from that goes into the calculation, how it flows through your models, once the output of the model, and then the disclosure, and that you have to have good governance from beginning to end, and in particular, like I talked about, if you're using third-party data or relying on other usage from other parties. I think the other point that's come up a bunch is that this applies to both small and large institutions, more sophisticated, less sophisticated, financial services, non-financial services, and that there's flexibility within the model to accommodate those different types of companies.
So basically, your point is that everyone needs good controls and processes. They don't all need to be the same.
Right.
But for your facts and circumstances, you have to make sure you have the right controls and processes.
Right. And I think the other point would be is that since we have the deferral for companies who are not adopting on 1/1/2020, don't meet those requirements, there'll be time for folks to take a step back and think about what they're doing, but keep the foot on their gas for their implementation and also benefit from some of the learnings of those adopters on 1/1/2020.
Yeah, and Seth, you briefly just now mentioned day two. Is there anything specific about day two that would be different from a process control perspective?
No, I think it's just things are going to change. Everyone's really set up for, they're doing SAB 74 disclosures now. They're getting set for what happens on day one, but it's what's going to happen as numbers change, as their assumptions change, as models change, as the environment, economic environment changes, what's going to happen, and then what's that going to look like?
So your point is basically look beyond your day one adoption, which everyone's been running towards, and make sure you have the right controls and processes for day two.
Right, and then the level of sophistication will obviously be different depending upon the type of organization.
Okay, that makes sense. And then Seth, in the webcast, we mentioned briefly that last week PwC hosted a roundtable for investors and analysts. I think there were about 30 investors and analysts there, and we got a lot of questions. Can you summarize, I know we talked about it in the webcast, but can you give us some more sense of what investors and analysts are asking about?
Yeah, I think you're right. They were, maybe surprisingly or not surprisingly, quite vocal.
Yes.
And I think, for starters, a lot of them didn't understand the model. In some cases, didn't necessarily understand the model they have today, but they've gotten more educated on that. And then trying to reconcile or wrap their heads around what's going to change and how it's going to be different. So I think that was one of the starting points. So how's the model going to change? What information are they going to be presented with in terms of disclosures? And what types of questions can they ask or should they ask to the companies that they either cover from an analyst perspective or are looking at for investment purposes? So I think a lot of it was educational, but then understanding how is it going to change and what's it going to look like from a comparability perspective amongst different institutions.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really struck me in listening is that they were very focused that they don't just want numbers, but they want to understand why people have made changes or what conclusions that they're reaching.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think also what questions can they ask, should they ask? And as they get more up to speed on what the model actually says or doesn't say, I think then those questions might become more informed. And there were also some market participants from institutions that are covered by some of these investors and analysts. And I think they were open about the types of information that they would be able to produce. So I think it was a good dialogue from that perspective.
Great. Thank you, Seth. That was very helpful. So then let me turn to the next topic we discussed on the webcast, which is revenue, and specifically related to the accounting for principal versus agent, also known as gross versus net. So, Angela, during the webcast, you gave an example of two parties that are involved in transferring a physical good, in this example, a piece of equipment to a customer. And then you talked about the concept of control in making your gross versus net assessment. And when I'm thinking about it, if I'm thinking about a physical good, it's pretty easy to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about control. But then a lot of revenue contracts that involve multiple parties involve a service. And so then how do you think about the concept of control when you're talking about a service?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question that comes up a lot. So as the company, you're not the one actually performing the service. You know, another party is the performing the service. The question is, how could you, quote unquote, control that service? And the FASB talked about broadly three different ways you could control a service. One way is that you're actually directing that other party to perform the services on your behalf. So you're telling them who to do the services for and maybe how to do the services. So you're still controlling the services, but asking someone else to perform them for you. So that's the first way. The second way would be to obtain the right to the services in advance. So the example of this is an airline ticket. So when you would, like a travel agent, buy an airline ticket and then sell it to someone else, you're not going to fly the plane, right? But you've actually obtained the right to the airline flight via that ticket and obtained that in advance.
Oh, and in that example then, if you didn't resell it, you would have still paid the airline for it, and it would have been sold.
Yeah, no. So you could have used it yourself, or you could transfer that right to someone else. The third type of way you can control a service is when you take a service that someone else is performing and combine it with other goods and services into one combined output. So the end user is getting something that's really a combination of things you're doing along with services that other parties are performing. That last one shows how important that first step in the process is, which is identifying the specified good and service that's being performed for the end user, because that's where you have to establish, is it just one thing the end consumer is getting, or is it multiple things? Because if it's just one thing, and then there's inputs that you control as part of making that combined output, then that would cause you to be the principal because you're controlling those inputs.
So then does that really go to making sure you properly assess the performance obligations in the contract?
Yeah, definitely the same concept. So it's looking at the distinct goods and services being provided to the end customer. So typically when we see an arrangement that involves services, it's going to fall broadly into one of those three categories, and that really helps you navigate, you know, whether or not the company is controlling a service. And interestingly, if you look at the speech that the SEC staff gave, the consultation they're talking about is one that involved services. And in the consultation that they discussed, the company was providing a service, another party was actually doing some of the services that the company could not do themselves. They didn't have the specialty to perform the services. So they had to use this other party to perform the service. And so they consulted on whether they could still be the principal. And the staff did not object because even though the company could not do the services themselves, they were directing another party to perform.
So you actually mentioned on the webcast that this is an area of a lot of questions. And would you, you know, it does not have to be scientific, but would you say that most of your questions are then more on the side of service, or you're getting questions on both services and physical goods?
It's a little bit across the board because, like, for the example I gave of the drop ship during the webcast, we get questions like that. Even though it involves a physical good, there can still be judgment around whether or not it's being you control that physical good. But definitely services are challenging, and then also intangibles. So when we get into the internet space and things like internet advertising, that's where applying some of these control concepts can be really judgmental.
Okay, that's helpful. And then, Angela, I also very briefly asked you about comment letters, but we didn't have a lot of time to get into that on the webcast. And I know there's been a lot of interest we gave a good update on comment letters earlier in the year, but then I know there's continued to be comment letters on revenue, and then specifically in the area of gross versus net. So any observations from those comments?
Yeah, I mean, gross versus net continues to be, I'd say, in the top 10 of types of comments coming in related to revenue. And generally, the staff is asking a comment because the conclusions in the footnotes are not clear. The footnotes are not clear about the judgments being made, the conclusions reached. And so the staff is asking questions or asking for clarity in those disclosures. And one big thing that I've noticed is that if a company talks about those indicators, you know, primarily responsible and price discretion and inventory risk, but never mentions control, the staff will often ask a question and say, please explain how you've assessed whether or not you control the specified good or service, because they're looking at, hey, you just jumped right to the indicators, right?
Right.
And we'll ask questions about that. So generally what I've seen people in response to the SEC's comments have added more clarity to their disclosures, more detail, been more specific about the assessment of control. And sometimes, I mean, the staff has dug into the accounting a little bit, but generally we're seeing these comments resolve through additional disclosure.
So then, Angela, thank you for those comments on comment letters. It's a very good segue into our next topic, which I had Mark Jerusalem on talking about leasing comment letters. And Mark, not surprisingly, we got a lot of questions, a lot of interest in comment letters. And you had mentioned on the webcast that there weren't enough comments yet to see trends, but there were a common thread among many of the comments.
And the common thread, as we've mentioned a couple times now, is that the staff was really looking for transparent and specific disclosures. So they seem to be asking about things where the disclosure was perhaps more vague or more boilerplate or not specifically unique to that registrant's, you know, specific leases. In those cases, they were asking for more information, especially when things seem to be out of the ordinary.
Okay, so then, Mark, it makes definitely makes sense we're getting comments on disclosure given the expansion and increase in disclosures, both from a qualitative and quantitative perspective. During the webcast, we didn't talk about this, but we got some specific questions on interim leasing disclosures. So it's good news. I guess people are already looking ahead to next quarter. But as a reminder, 2019 was the first year of adoption for public companies, and they've had to provide the annual disclosures each quarter. But now companies are starting to look ahead to Q1 of next year, and that would be the first time they're making their interim disclosures. So what should they be thinking about?
Well, first of all, kudos to those companies that are looking ahead already to the first quarter of next year. Kind of, they must have their year-end already kind of down pat.
All the right controls and processes in place.
Right. So here's an area where I finally feel that I can give, like, really good news, because there's really very few disclosure requirements for the interims. Okay. As a matter of fact, lessees don't have any specific disclosure requirements for the interims. So there's no explicit specific disclosure requirements.
So, Angela, are you having some revenue envy that you guys have required interim disclosures?
Well, I guess it takes some of the judgment out of it if you just have to put all the disclosures in.
Well, there is one thing to take into account, which I'll get to in just a second. But for lessors, there is a single disclosure requirement, and that is that disclosures have to present in a table all the bits and pieces of their lease revenue. So if they have operating leases, they would have to disclose their fixed payments, their variable rental income. If they have sales-type leases, they'd have to disclose the sale and the interest income on the investment in the lease. So that they have to disclose. That is the only explicit interim disclosure requirement that lessors have to follow. Now, having said that there are no specific disclosure requirements in the leasing standard, you know, anybody who's doing interim reporting has to follow the guidance in Topic 270 on general interim reporting guidance, not leasing specific. And that guidance would require somebody to disclose any changes in situations that would have a significant change in their financial position or changes in principles or in estimates or any other changes or any other information that would make those interim reported amounts perhaps different from the previous year. So companies always have to use some judgment to determine whether or not they do have any leasing transactions or leasing changes that do need to be disclosed on an interim basis.
Okay, that's helpful. And then, Mark, one of the comments that you talked about specifically was related to variable payments. And in your example, you mentioned that if the company was combining lease and non-lease components, then any variable payment associated with the non-lease component would be included in variable lease expense. And we went over that fairly quickly in the webcast, so can you elaborate now?
Sure. So the standard includes a practical expedient that lessees could elect to apply, where rather than separating their non-lease components and their lease components, they could combine them. Now, the advantage of doing that is that if you're not separating them, then you don't have to allocate any portions of the fixed payments between the non-lease and the lease components, and you don't have to allocate any portion of the variable payments between the lease and non-lease components. So on the surface, it seems simpler. Companies should just bear in mind, however, that, you know, if they're choosing to do that, then everything gets characterized as a lease. And so they may have situations where, you know, they think they're leasing something pretty straightforward, but they have a lot of lease expense related to that item because they've elected to combine the non-lease component. I mean, in some ways, it is what it is. That's the choice that they have to make. But if they do make that choice and it makes the lease look a little bit out of kilter, then they should probably have some explanation about it.
So it goes back to the point you made about making sure you have good qualitative disclosure in that circumstance.
Right.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So let's move on to our next resolution, which is staying up to date on tax matters. And not surprisingly, there was a lot of interest in the tax simplification proposed to ASU that we talked about that we're hopefully going to see before the end of the year, maybe even by the time this podcast gets issued. And one of the questions people had was, you mentioned a simplification that would permit companies to allocate tax provisions to single-member LLCs. So on the surface, that does not seem like a simplification. It seems like a complication. So people are asking why you would want to do that.
Yeah, so for a lot of companies, you may not want to. You really have to think about what is the purpose of the separate company financial statements that you're issuing? Who's using them? Why are you issuing them in the first place? Probably the most common sector where we would expect them to probably continue to allocate tax provisions like they have been in the past is in your sector, Heather, in the utility space. And that's because many utility companies, you know, they have to do separate statements for their state regulators and their rate-regulated entities. Those statements feed into the rates that they are allowed to charge. And so from the company's perspective, it makes the most sense to make sure that those financials cover all of their costs, even if they're not necessarily, you know, that entity may not be the direct taxpayer, but the overall entity is paying taxes.
Yeah, I think, as I briefly mentioned on the webcast, this was very good news, I think, from a sector's perspective. Yeah. And I think especially the fact that I know when this was going through the deliberation process, there was discussion, should this be mandatory one way or the other? And I think the fact that they landed on an option, which really lets people line up with their facts and circumstances, will really help, you know, to make this part of the financial statements more meaningful.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, and then another question that came up is that we talked about the tax simplification ASU, but we didn't mention the FASB tax disclosure project. And they were sort of on the same track at one time, and then it's been basically radio silence. So can you actually, for the benefit of our listeners who may have even put this out of mind, can you just give a quick reminder of what that project is and then when we might expect to see more?
Yeah, so the disclosure project around taxes had its, I'll call it, rebirth this year. An ED was initially issued back in 2016. Comments came in, and then the FASB basically put it on hold as tax reform unfolded because they didn't want to kind of put the cart before the horse. So then they issued another ED, an exposure draft, in 2019. You know, we expect them to kind of get moving on it again in 2020, in the first half of the year. So I wouldn't kind of read too much into it. I think it's just, you know, too many things to do and not enough time.
Yeah, well, I think even the effective dates ASU that Maria talked about would not have been on the radar back in the spring.
That's right.
When these projects were moving along. So maybe it's prioritization. And
That's
I think,
right.
again, as we talked about on the webcast, nice that it's a simplification one that moved forward because there is some good news in there for some companies.
Yeah, because the disclosure one is mostly additions to your disclosure population, not subtractions.
Right. So. and then, Cassie, maybe just going to the other topic we talked about, which was the global tax law changes, so maybe less good news for our listeners. But one of the things you mentioned that we got a few questions was that sometimes the tax impact of a law change happens in a country outside of the country where the law change occurred. And we got a few questions where people trying to understand what we meant by that.
Okay, so maybe an example would help here. So say you are a company that is sitting in country A, and you borrowed money from your sister company who's sitting in country B. And for the last number of years, you've been generating losses for tax purposes because your interest expense is just so big, it just puts you in a loss every year. So you probably had a valuation allowance on that all this time, but you have a big net deferred tax asset with a valuation allowance on it. So say there's then a law change in country B where your sister company is, and the law change says if the entity, your sister company, isn't including that interest income in their taxable income, which before they didn't have to under the law.
Yeah.
But if they're not including it now going forward, then you can't take the deduction in the other country. Like, it has to be income on one side and deduction on the other now. Well, as a total company, you may just say, well, I don't want income for whatever reason. I don't want to include that interest income in country B. So I'm going to stop deducting in country A. Well, the impact of that is if those deductions were the only thing putting you in a loss in country A, you may now have a big valuation allowance release coming your way. And in some of these countries, we've had a couple situations where those valuation allowance releases could be like $1 billion. I mean, big, big numbers. And so so that's kind of a situation, you know, an example maybe to help kind of solidify what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's a great example, because even when you were talking about it before, simplistically, I could see the impact, but that's way beyond what I would have thought. So it's very helpful. And I think it's a great reminder. You mentioned all the complication with these global tax issues, and that's important to stay on top of them. But I just think this is yet another reminder of really making sure you understand all the jurisdictions where you're doing business and these potential impacts, and that you're keeping an eye on potential changes.
And that those countries are talking to one another.
Right. Yep. Right. All right. Very good. Cassie, thank you. So then why don't we wrap things up with a few questions related to standard setting. And a question that we got during the webcast and that has been coming up is, you know, we were talking about reference rate reform, LIBOR, and in our discussion of the conference on current SEC and PCAOB developments, we mentioned that there's a feeling that the effort there has been underestimated. So Seth, maybe just to ask you, I know you're working with a lot of clients. Are clients focused on this? And if they're not, what should they be thinking about?
I think there's a lot to focus on there, right? So when you think about, like, an accounting perspective, you have the FASB is working on their project on reference rate reform to try to ease the burden of the transition to LIBOR from a hedge accounting perspective, modification perspective, all those types of things. But I think off to the side, you have, it's just a massive organizational change from a systems perspective, from a interfacing with client perspective, if you're a financial institution or otherwise, like where the different rates, reference rates sit within your organizations, how you're going to modify your contracts, potentially put in fallback language, all these different types of things. There's a lot of work to do. You know, we talked about CECL from all the work you have to do there from a process and systems perspective. This is no different. In some cases, probably might be more because it impacts, especially for financial institutions, their whole organization. So I think, yeah, we're definitely, you know, we've been educating clients on that and helping them think through that. But it's definitely a large, you know, finance transformation effort. Accounting and FASB has a component of it. Tax has a component of it. Valuation as a component of it, but it's definitely a system-wide change that I think there are a lot of people that are definitely focused on it, but it's going to require a lot of work.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's almost like companies with teams focused on CECL need to turn to that next, and then companies that are still implementing CECL need to actually put this on their agenda, because this is going to impact all companies, small, and it could impact throughout the organization depending on the contracts.
It definitely will. The contracts, the type of organization you are, and definitely larger companies where this has a bigger impact. And there are some companies that maybe they don't think it has an impact, but it might, similar to CECL in some ways, would have steering committees and groups that they've put together to basically come work on that whole from project perspective.
And then Maria, specific from a standard setting perspective, what do we see, or when do we expect to see something from the FASB?
Yeah, so the FASB is working hard on finalizing all of the input that they received. They're drafting the final standard. We do expect to see it early in Q1. So companies will have that guidance and can start to make those contract changes that are necessary.
But it sounds like, to Seth's point, do not wait.
Do not wait.
Right. And then I would also just mention, we did recently, last week, issue an In the Loop that talks about sort of business considerations from a library perspective, and definitely recommend that people check that out. So maybe then, just to wrap things up, I'm going to move to a project that we didn't talk about, but that's gotten a lot of press, and we got a few questions about, which would be the status of the invitation to comment on Goodwill. And we mentioned that in the past webcast. And since that time, comment letter period closed, and the FASB's had roundtables. And we got a few questions just asking timing from a FASB perspective, and then the ISB has its project out there. So what's happening with those two projects, Maria?
Yeah, so the short answer is the timing is TBD, because there is so much work to be done.
Yeah.
The roundtables were very productive, but there were a variety of views expressed. So just to recap, you know, we talked about this last quarter, but there was several questions in the invitation to comment. You know, do companies believe that goodwill amortization should be permitted or required? If amortization is available, you know, how would it be done? Would the FASB prescribe a useful life, or would, you know, it be done case by case? Would intangible assets be potentially subsumed into goodwill? You know, a lot to really think through, and a variety of views. Another thing that came up was whether amortization should be required, given that comparability is so important to investors. And then, speaking of comparability, you have the fact that the IASB has a similar project on goodwill, as you mentioned. Right now, you know, the two frameworks are fairly well converged on goodwill, but should they kind of move in different directions, that would change. And so for multinational companies, you know, that could have a big impact. So much work to be done, but, you know, we'll continue to follow it.
Yep, so it sounds like definitely more to come.
Definitely.
Good. Well, I'd like to thank all of you for joining me, both for the webcast and for this podcast. I think some great information that we're getting out to our viewers and listeners. So thanks again. That does it for 2019. Thanks again for joining me here each week. I'll see you all in 2020. It'll be a new year with new weekly topics and some exciting new developments, so don't miss an episode. Our first episode back will be released on January 7th, 2020. To be sure you don't miss it, subscribe to our podcast series wherever you find your content. And I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out to me on LinkedIn with questions, suggestions, or just to follow me to stay up on the latest content. For PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.